12. Despite my fears, despite my worries, I did not see Irene again. And though periodically I still heard the sound of a baby crying, it was always in the daytime, and always far off. And I was almost certain that the wailing infants were real children. Scott Spencer emailed a response to me several days later, informing me that the Ghost Pursuers team was on a hiatus. They were finished shooting for the season, and wouldn't need to start working on any new episodes for another 6 months, if the show was renewed, he said, which at this point was by no means guaranteed. Hoping to take advantage of what had seemed to me like a mutual respect, I emailed him back immediately and laid all my cards on the table, letting him know that this was personal, and suggesting that if Ghost Pursuers did have another season, I'd be providing his team with an episode that would tie into their two Most Haunted Town in America shows and could serve as an easily promotable season opener. Spencer still wasn't buying what I was selling, even after I went into more detail about the Frank connection. But he was nice enough to provide me with email addresses for Evan and Owen, the show's writers. They were more than happy to discuss ideas with me. Between seasons, they were officially unemployed. And though they were each working on spec scripts of their own, the experience in Randall had made them true believers and put stars in their eyes. They were both open to collaborating with me on either a Ghost Pursuers episode or something totally unconnected to the program. We set up a time and place to meet, next Wednesday for lunch at a Mexican restaurant in Whittier, halfway between their home base in Los Angeles and my Orange County office. I'd been meaning to look up the whereabouts of Mark Goodwin since my trip to Randall, but events had conspired to put that off. Now, however, I made the effort, and to my surprise, found him easily on Facebook. He was a physical therapist, and he lived now in Tucson. In the displayed photo, he looked older than I expected, older than me, though we were the same age. I searched that lined face in vain for some resemblance to the young boy I knew in Randall. It was the eyes that usually remained the same, despite changes to the flesh surrounding them, but Mark's eyes looked haunted, and I knew that he'd had a hard life since I'd last seen him. I started off slowly, with a friend request. He responded almost before I was through typing, as though he'd been waiting for this moment. I knew it was a coincidence. He just happened to be online at the same time I made my request, but it seemed like fate. And we IM'd back and forth, quickly catching up on each other's histories. Mark, it turned out, was divorced, with no children. Thankfully, he wrote. His ex-wife was in jail, doing 10 years for drug trafficking. His parents were both dead, though he did not tell me how they'd died, and I did not ask. He had no contact with either his brother or his sister. The last he'd heard, Dean was somewhere in the Northwest, doing manual labor. He had no idea where Janine was. There was nothing self-pitying about his matter-of-fact descriptions, but he seemed to have had a sad life, and I wondered how much of that could be attributed to Frank. I didn't want to jump right in with that, so I approached the subject obliquely, over a period of days, pretending as though Frank was just one of many childhood remembrances that were returning to me since Mark and I had reconnected. By now, we were talking to each other over the phone, and to my surprise, he admitted flat out that Frank had ruined his life. It was that house, he said. Everything started to go wrong when we moved into that house. I told you it was haunted, right? I saw it for myself, I told him. I thought about mentioning Ghost Pursuers, but I wanted to hear what he had to say. I could go into all that later. Well, it affected us. Dean and I both got into drugs, and I'm sure part of it was finding that dead kid in the basement, but that wasn't all of it. Janine turned into a complete slut, started fucking every guy she saw. My parents, he sighed. We never really talked in that family, but from what I gathered, what I could piece together from the arguments I heard through the walls and the bits of conversation I happened on, my dad was supposed to have had his tubes tied, but my mom was pregnant again. She swore that it was his, but he never believed it. Not that it mattered. She had a miscarriage. I remembered suddenly that Mark had had a baby sister, though I couldn't remember her name. What about your little sister? I asked. The baby. What happened to her? Mark was silent for a moment. She fell out a window. An upstairs window. Landed on a rock, cracked her head open, and died. Oh my God. That window, Mark spoke slowly. Frank made it too low. Kate was only one and barely able to walk, but it was just the right height for her to put her hands on the sill, lean over, and fall out. You know Frank had no screens, and the window was open because it was hot, and we'd opened it to let the air in. I'm not sure how Kate got upstairs. She was supposed to be in my parents' room in her crib, taking a nap. I'm sorry, I told him. I couldn't think of anything else to say. Even after we sold that house and moved, it seemed like it stayed with us. The Frank effect, I called it. Bad luck just seemed to follow us everywhere we went. Did I tell you how my parents died? My mouth felt dry. No. It was in the mid-90s. I was in Phoenix, working, going part-time to a JC, and they were living up in Montana, where my dad had gotten a job with some copper mining company. One night, middle of the night, I get this call. It's from the Missoula Police Department. My parents were in a single vehicle crash. They smashed into a tree and were both killed on impact. Jesus. The thing is, they weren't drinking. There wasn't any. No one could find a reason for the accident. But on their answering machine, though, was a call. From Frank. Holy shit. Yeah. I don't know how he got their number or where he was calling from, or even if it was the first time he called. But I recognized his voice immediately, even though I hadn't heard it since he sold us the house when I was, what, 12? He was telling them to drive to Helena and meet him. Didn't explain why or anything, at least not in the message. And on the way there is where they were killed. It was past time for me to come clean, and I told Mark about the disintegration of my own family, and about my recent reacquaintance with Frank's world, from Brad and his mom, all the way up to my trip to Frank's house. I left out nothing, and was glad I didn't. Because he, too, had seen Irene. Like me, Mark thought he'd been the only one creeped out by Frank's wife. Frank's negative qualities were so aggressively upfront, and his wife so cowed and submissive, that it seemed wrong to feel anything but pity for her. But though he'd seen her only briefly, Mark had had the same reaction to Irene as me, and he, too, had had recurring nightmares about her as a child. He'd also seen her recently. It had been decades since Mark had even thought about Irene, but several weeks ago, he'd gone before dawn to the physical therapy center to accommodate a client who requested a session before work, and he'd seen an old lady standing beneath the Palo Verde tree at the edge of the empty parking lot, partially lit by a nearby street lamp. Irene Watkins was the name that came immediately to mind, although he had no idea why. Not only had he not seen her in decades, but he could not even remember what she looked like. Still, something in the woman's stance or body type seemed familiar, and the connection his brain made was to Irene. He did remember the nightmares he'd had as a kid, and as a slight warm breeze fluttered the dress she was wearing, Mark hurried inside the building. He might be an adult now, but the thought of Irene still creeped him out, and even if the woman in the parking lot was just some anonymous homeless person, there was something eerie about the way she stood there, all alone in the near darkness, unmoving, her billowy dress flapping gently around her. Mark made sure to lock the door behind him before walking down the corridor to the exercise room. He turned the lights on as he stepped inside. Irene was standing outside the floor-to-ceiling window, pressing her face against the glass and grinning in at him. There was no doubt this time that it was her. He recognized that wrinkled visage, remembered it clearly from childhood. And though he was a grown man now, he was filled with fear. He was glad that he'd made sure to lock the door, and even more glad that he was inside the building while she was outside. Acting far braver than he felt, Mark strode over to the window and rapped on it, his fist directly in front of her face. "You're trespassing!" he yelled, though he was not sure she could hear him through the thick glass. "Get out of here, or I'm calling the police!" Still grinning, she moved away from the window, backing up without looking until her pale face and fluttering clothes faded into the pre-dawn darkness. There was a blurry smudge on the glass where her face had pressed against it, and Mark stared at the spot, feeling suddenly cold. He had seen similarly blurred imprints on windows at his apartment and on his car over the years, not giving them much thought, assuming they were caused by dew or dust or heat or atmospheric conditions. Unable to take his eyes off the spot, he knew now that they'd been imprinted on the glass by Irene's face. She was real, tangible. "But I had the same impression you did," Mark said. "That she was dead."
"I have only the dark wife now."
"I'm pretty sure she is," I told him. "Did you try to go after her or anything?"
"Hell no. I stayed inside. In fact, I went around checking doors and making sure they were locked, just in case she came back. I didn't relax until my client showed up."
"Any signs of her since?"
"No." He was quiet for a very long moment.
"So what do we do now? What happens next?"
"I don't know," I admitted. "We left it there, but it made me feel uneasy that he too had seen Irene. I didn't know what it meant, but I didn't like it. I didn't like it at all." For the next week, everything seemed a little bit off. There was nothing I could point to specifically, nothing I could really put my finger on, but the clothes I chose each morning turned out to be either too warm or too cool for the weather. None of the listings I showed impressed any of my prospective clients. Terry and I weren't in sync sexually. I was twice given the wrong takeout order for lunch, and the Lincoln seemed to be even more sluggish and unreliable than usual. I was grateful for the weekend, and I used my Saturday to rewrite some poorly conceived property descriptions that I'd put on our website a few days earlier. When the phone rang, I let Terry pick it up in the kitchen. A moment later, she walked into my office with a bemused expression, holding the phone in her hand.
"For you," she said.
"Who is it?"
"Julie," she said. "My sister."
"She wants to talk to me?"
"Apparently so."
Terry sounded as surprised as I felt. She handed me the phone. This was weird. I hadn't spoken to Julie since the trip to Ramona, and truth be told, not much even then. I barely knew the woman.
"Hello?" I said. "Daniel, hi. Do you have a minute? I have a few questions I thought you might be able to help me with."
"Sure," I said. "What do you need?"
"You're in real estate, right? So you probably know something about home improvement related issues. I was wondering if you could give me some advice. See, we hired this guy to put in a new toilet. For the past month or so, it would keep running after you flushed it, and you had to jiggle the handle to get it to stop. That's okay, we could live with that. But a few nights ago, the tank started leaking. We found out about it in the morning when we woke up, and the whole bathroom was flooded. I mopped it all up. Ron shut off the valve or water pipe or whatever, and we decided to just replace the whole thing. We had this handyman do it, a jack-of-all-trades kind of guy. He charged us about half of what the cheapest plumber would have cost us, but he ended up doing a really crummy job. A day later, we had to start jiggling the new handle to get it to stop running. Now the guy says he won't come back and fix it unless we pay him again, even though we think after one day, there should be some sort of warranty. I thought you might know something about what to do. Whether we have any rights here, whether we should file a suit in small claims court or what.
Is there any way to get in touch with this guy?"
"We have his phone number. He was recommended to us by some friends who had him work on a deck in their backyard. I guess they had no problems. His name's Frank Wharton."
Frank Wharton. I didn't hear anything else.
Frank? It couldn't be.
But it had to be.
I was holding the phone so tightly that my fingers hurt.
While it was just barely possible that this was all a coincidence, it was not the least bit probable. This whole thing was way too close to home, and my mind was spinning as I traced the connections. Despite what Julie might think, she and her husband had not hired some random handyman. Frank had clearly set his sights on working for Julie, because she was Terry's sister. Hell, he might have even found some way to break that toilet himself just to get the ball rolling. Why? Because he was stalking me, playing with me, going after people in my life, trying to keep me involved after I'd sworn to stay out of all this. But I couldn't get past the logistics. I'd left Frank in his house in the middle of nowhere, Nevada, less than 2 months ago. In that time, he'd not only tracked me down, but found out that I was dating Terry, hunted down Terry's sister Julie, then wormed his way into the life of Julie's friends, doing a good enough job building their deck that they had recommended him to her? How was that possible? There was a pause in the conversation. Julie was obviously waiting for me to respond to something she'd said, and I had to come clean. I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. I said, what should we do? Objectively, she and her husband probably should take Frank to small claims court, and it would serve him right if they did. But I was afraid of letting him get any more involved in their lives. I knew what Frank was capable of, and without letting on about how much I knew, I told her that lawsuits against itinerant handymen never worked out. Even if a judgment went against them, they just pulled up stakes and disappeared without paying restitution. It's more trouble than it's worth, I assured her. The best idea is to chalk this up as a learning experience and hire a competent professional to do the job, preferably someone licensed and bonded. Oh, I could hear the disappointment in her voice, and I knew she wanted another answer from me. But my goal was to get her as far away from Frank's clutches as I could. Here, I'll let you talk to Terry, I said, and handed off the phone. Terry walked back into the kitchen, the sisters talking for another 10 minutes or so, while I tried to return to my work. My head was spinning, and though I attempted to write a description for a new listing, the words couldn't come. I kept thinking about Frank, wondering if he'd stolen anything from Terry's sister. A shadow fell over my desk. So, Terry said. So? Let it go? That was your advice? She was hoping for something more professional. More specific. It was Frank, I told her. Frank put in her toilet. Terry's face grew pale. I nodded, standing. I don't know how, don't know why, but it's him. And my thought was to get her as far away from him as fast as possible. He's coming after you, Terry said, cutting straight to the chase. I shrugged. Maybe. Jesus. There's no reason to panic. You need to call the police. I'd been thinking the same thing, and I nodded slowly. She was right. Even if I'd wanted to, I couldn't Hardy Boys my way out of this one, and I didn't want to. I wanted to turn this over to the authorities and have the law toss Frank in jail and throw away the key. I wanted him out of my life, and I wanted him punished. For Billy. I looked up the number of the Ramona Police Department and called to tell them about a handyman preying on local homeowners, including, I said, my future sister-in-law. Terry gave me a silent kiss on the cheek for that one. The sergeant I spoke to didn't seem all that interested in what I had to say, but I couldn't blame him. Even after framing Frank as a scam artist who was wanted for questioning in a 30-year-old murder investigation, my actual facts were pretty light. And a leaky toilet wasn't that big a deal, even in Ramona. I gave the man Julie's name and number, since she was the victim within his jurisdiction, and I told him to call the Randall Sheriff's Office for more information about Frank. I also let him know that he could call me anytime, though that hardly seemed likely. I wasn't sure how much good it did to complain, but I felt better for having told someone, and I figured at the very least, it might put some pressure on Frank if he knew the law was sniffing around. Hopefully he would panic, leave, and let Julie alone. I was able to get back to work and finished rewriting my property descriptions so that they sounded enticing. Casting a wider net, I sent follow-up emails to the handful of Orange County residents who'd filled out our mass-mailed postcards and indicated that they might be interested in selling their homes. Finally, I took a break. Terry was cooking something in the kitchen, and the smell of it reminded me of my childhood. It was some sort of soup that was simmering on the stove, and though I hadn't thought of it in years, I remember that my mom often made soups and stews and chilies when I was little, letting them cook all day in a big black pot until the entire house smelled of herbs and vegetables, broth and meat. Billy and I used to love to hang around the kitchen when Mom was cooking, particularly if it was a rainy day and the windows were all fogged up from the heat of the stove and oven, because she used to give us tiny little bowls of whatever she was making so we could taste it ahead of time and let her know how it was. I felt sad all of a sudden. But I was happy to be sad, grateful to Terry for stirring up memories that I hadn't remembered I possessed. After dinner, I got in touch with Mark. Like veterans who had been through a war together, we were products of a horrific shared experience, and it somehow made me feel better to confide in him. I didn't call him on the phone, because I didn't want to frighten him and make him think it was some sort of emergency, but I did email him, and again, Mark IM'd me immediately, as though he'd been waiting for my message. I explained the situation, and he offered to back me up with the Ramona police, if need be. I told him that wouldn't be necessary, and promised to keep him up to date before signing off. That night, I had a nightmare. Not about Frank, not about Irene, but about my mom. I was sitting in the pancake restaurant across from the cemetery, eating alone next to one of the front windows, and when I looked up from my breakfast, I could see her walking toward me across the street. The clothes in which she'd been buried had rotted away, gaping holes revealing peeling gray flesh underneath. Most of her hair had fallen out, but the sections that hadn't were white and freakishly long. Her blanched face wore an expression of fierce malevolence. Her pupilless eyes were trained directly on me. I quickly got up from the table, the plate of half-finished pancakes falling into my lap. Ignoring the mess, I looked frantically for another way out of the restaurant, even as I kept glancing back to the window and seeing my dead mom grow even closer. I knew she wanted to kill me. Pushing my way past a waitress, I ran through a pair of swinging doors into the kitchen. The cooks ignored me as I hurried behind them to the back door, pushing it open and dashing out of the restaurant into the parking lot, where my dad's rotting corpse was waiting for me, arms outstretched. I woke up sweating. I didn't know what the dream meant, but I didn't want to know. Terry was sound asleep next to me, snoring. Afraid to go back to sleep, afraid of having another nightmare, I stayed awake the rest of the night, staring up at the ceiling and trying not to think. On Wednesday, I was supposed to meet Evan and Owen for lunch. In preparation, I had written out a timeline, the closest thing to a history of Frank that I could piece together. I'd compiled all of his known aliases, all of his known addresses, the names of everyone I could think of who'd had any contact with the man, and I'd listed everything I knew chronologically, hoping the writers could use their ghost pursuers' contacts to dig up additional information and figure out what the hell was going on. Knowing I'd be gone for the afternoon, I went into the office early, hoping to pick up some new listings. Sales had fallen off in the past few weeks, part of the normal cycle of the business, and I wanted to do everything I could to stave off a longer slowdown. May arrived late, after both Mike and Jim had already come in and then driven out with clients to look at properties. That was unusual for her. She was far more subdued than usual, and when I asked if everything was all right, she seemed vague, distracted, and didn't really give me an answer. "What's wrong?" I pressed. "Nothing," she said curtly. "I'm fine." It was clear that she didn't want to talk. We all knew what May was like when she got in one of these moods, and I gave her a wide berth the rest of the morning. My meeting was for noon, so just to be on the safe side, I left for Whittier shortly after 11. I was 10 minutes early, but Evan and Owen were even earlier. I saw them as I pulled up, sitting on a bench in front of the building, texting on their phones. "Hey, guys," I said. "Long time," Evan said, fist bumping me. Owen held up his hand in a gesture of greeting. The restaurant was a windowless hole in the wall with red Naugahyde booths, dark paneling, and velvet matador paintings. Located on an uncrowded side street between a closed hair salon and a plumbing supply store, it was completely nondescript, and I wondered how the writers had discovered the place. As it turned out, Evan had grown up in Whittier, and as a kid, his family had eaten here often. The place was surprisingly crowded, and we had to wait several minutes for a table. "The food here's great," Evan said. "Old school, but great." After we were seated, I slid my printout across the formica table, thinking I should have brought a copy for each of them. "I wrote down what I know," I said, "to give you a place to start. Over enchiladas, I came clean about all of it. Frank, Irene, the crying baby. These guys were used to hearing confessions from housewives who thought their laundry rooms were haunted, so there was no reason to hold anything back. Even if they didn't believe something, they could still investigate it."
"This sounds awesome," Evan said when I was done. "We could build a whole show just around the search for Frank. Call it The Search for Frank."
Evan nodded.
"Hell yeah, I'd watch it. Movie adaptation would be even better."
They were getting off on their Hollywood tangent. I tried to rein them back in. "Listen, guys, feel free to take anything you want from this for a show or a movie or whatever. But before you do that, I need you to find out as much as you can about what's going on. This is my life here, and it's affecting other people besides me. We're not dealing with some scratching sounds in an attic. People have died." Owen nodded soberly.
"Got it."
An attractive young woman in tight jeans passed by our table.
"I'd like to sniff her panties on a hot summer day," Evan whispered.
He and Owen laughed conspiratorially.
"Focus,"
I wanted to tell them. They were acting like giggling high school students, and it made me wonder if they would have the discipline to see this through. They did ask appropriate questions, though, and Owen actually took notes on a tablet, so I still hoped that something would come of this. "So?" Terry asked when she got home that night. "How did it go?" "Okay, I guess." "You guess?" "They're immature, but they definitely have contacts, and they know this ghost hunting stuff." I shook my head.
"Jesus Christ, ghost hunting.
If you had told me a year ago that I'd be involved with anything like that, I'd have said you were nuts. What if I'd told you a year ago that we'd be living together?" I smiled.
"I'd have said you were nuts.
Things change."
"That they do," I agreed.
It made me wonder what would be happening a year from now. Me and Terry? I could still see us together. Maybe making plans for marriage, or even a family. But Frank, and all the stuff surrounding him, I had no idea where that would lead, and that's what scared me.